Was this a long time ago? My 10-year-old son, Joseph, asked me. The way he asked it made it clear that he wanted the answer to be yes. In fact, I wanted the answer to be yes, and actually, we all want the answer to be yes. Joseph had been sitting with me for just a little bit. I was watching the documentary 13th. It is about the 13th Amendment, which ended slavery, but the documentary is actually about how that slavery kind of just morphed into what first became Jim Crow and then later became the criminal justice system that some call the prison industrial complex. Just as Joseph sat down beside me, it was towards the end of the film and the footage of Eric Garner was flashing on the screen. It was Eric Garner being held down by the police while he was saying, "I can't breathe." And then right after that, it moved to Philando Castile in his car right after he was shot with his girlfriend saying, "We just had a broken taillight." Was this a long time ago? My son asked. We all want the answer to be yes. But instead, obviously, I had to go ahead and tell him no. It was just a couple of years ago. I didn't tell him, couldn't tell him, though, that this was not actually even the end of it, that it keeps happening. I couldn't tell him about Alton Sterling or Sandra Bland or Jordan Edwards or Jamar Clark. These sudden deaths, I could not tell him, especially about the lack of accountability that just keeps happening. Remember last week when I said 15 of the 30 people who are shot and murdered each day by guns are black men. And really, this is not a new situation. The only thing that is new is we happen to have easy access to filming it and posting it on social media. We may want to say that Black Lives Matter just the same, but in the US today, the reality is that it is not yet true. 1 year ago today, white supremacists marched through the campus of the University of Virginia with torches blazing. They had come to express their First Amendment rights, often by way of their Second Amendment displays. It is a new tactic you may have heard about in the Second Amendment work, the work for gun rights, is to claim that the display of a gun is actually about speech. The Reverend Susan Frederick Gray, our UUA president, was there in Charlottesville. She had come for the counter-protest. Before the march, interfaith leaders had gathered in the Presbyterian church nearby. They were praying, they were centering, they were connecting with one another, preparing for the next day. When they heard Nazi slogans outside, they realized they were surrounded. These protesters who had come to protect the symbols of the Confederacy, they'd already made their way through the campus. They were there at the church. After that, they went on to the synagogue. They were also there gathered in prayer. It was all just a preview, it turns out, of what happened the next morning. You may remember it was just a year ago, the images of the men, white men in military gear, all decked out with big guns and ammo, Frederick Gray describes. There were dozens of white supremacists marching down the street, chanting and yelling with shields and helmets, wooden clubs and sticks coming right at the faith leaders who'd gathered for the counter-protest. The peaceful protesters, the police, however, were nowhere to be seen. In her sermon describing Charlottesville, Frederick Gray invited those gathered to take just a moment to reflect on the fact that the police largely stood down to give space for armed white men carrying out intimidation and violence throughout the community of Charlottesville, and then compare that to what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, when unarmed black people came out to the streets to protest and mourn the killing of young Michael Brown and were met there with a militarized police force armed with tear gas and tanks. because black people are more dangerous, more powerful, bigger, or rather, that is what studies have shown that non-black people tend to believe about black folks. That they are more dangerous, powerful, bigger. They can do, these studies have come out. It is proven that these are the images that come to mind. We overestimate the strength, the power, the danger. Black folks and people with black skin. We have seen this play out recently in these overreactive calls to the police by white folks reporting suspicious behavior by black people. And let us realize that those white folks making those calls could be most any of us. And as long as we're on the subject, let's go ahead and promise that it won't be. It needn't be. Just go ahead and Google alternatives to calling the police. There's like four documents that come right up. It could be any of us. So let's decide together that it won't be. We also see this prejudice perception play out on a larger scale in the prison industrial complex that I mentioned earlier. Despite making up only 6.5% of the U.S. population, black people make up a little over 40% of the prison population. Now, if you are a white man, your chances you'll go to prison in your life is 1 in 17, which I already think is kind of high. 1 in 17. All of you white guys out there, there's more than 17 of you. Black folks, on the other hand, black men in particular, 1 in 3. 1 in 3. The image of the black man, especially, but all African Americans as criminal or as threatening, it likely lives somewhere in all of our brains, whether we want it to or not. Because it is like the air we breathe. It is subliminal. It is transmitted by culture, white culture, which I want to be careful of saying in a room of mostly white folks. Because what I don't want to do is get us all stuck in the middle of this sermon in a big old shame spiral. What Brené Brown calls a shame spiral. It's that thing where you get stuck and you don't know how to get out of it. It is where so many of us go when we start to talk about racism. Because as Robin DiAngelo says it, perhaps most fundamentally, anti-blackness comes out of the deep guilt about what we have done and what we continue to do, the unbearable knowledge of our complicity in the profound torture of black people from the past to the present. Shame and guilt like this, it is traumatic and also paralyzing. We feel shame existentially. It's not just that we did something wrong, but we are wrong. Humans will do everything we can to get out of that sense, that experience of shame and guilt, including coming up with all sorts of stories to justify what is unjustifiable. Or we will just get caught up in the shame spiral so that we cannot engage in the conversation at all. Like a lot of people, white people I know, I want to say with all sincerity, I know what it means to love a racist. And not just the like subconscious sort of racist that many of us are, most of us are, but like the overt sort. The sort that will say directly, I'm not sure I want to share a water fountain or a glass of water with that person, someone who would question someone's right to get in the same swimming pool. While I have not personally had to grapple with being the descendant of slave traders or plantation owners, I think hearing your grandmother ask if the newcomers are to coming to town are N-words, it carries its own lessons and its own shame. Vincent Harding, who I spoke about earlier, he used to say that racism is an injury to us all. He would remind us that we all have a story, probably many stories, but we all have that first story where we learned race and where we first felt that break in our spirit. It usually takes a while for white folks especially to pull it up in their consciousness, but usually once you start remembering it and start the telling, the stories pour out as do the tears. Racism breaks us all. It was Dr. Harding's way of getting white folks to talk about race, to take a seat at the table, to do our own work, to realize that we do have work to do. Part of white identity, after all, is its absence, its invisibility, its pretense that we are just plain humans. Part of white privilege is the opting out of these conversations about race and racism, the sense that racism is not a white thing, that white people know nothing about race, as if whiteness itself is not dependent on the idea of race and the propensity of racism. But there is a trade involved in this privilege of being plain old humans that if we dig deep, we know. It is a loss that is represented in the trade. The becoming absent, the invisibility, and the story that we had to buy into, we have to buy into in order to make right that cognitive dissonance of our complicity, to keep living in light of the trauma that we carry and this generational shame. It's one of the reasons that I think it is so hard to talk about race and racism in Fort Collins, because there are so many white folks here. So many white folks end up framing the conversations that we have, which means so many missed opportunities to talk about race and whiteness and the particular ways that race plays out in Northern Colorado. About 18 months ago, I was becoming friends with this woman, which, if you know me at all, I'm often talking about how I really work hard to try to make friends, and it is not the easiest thing in midlife, right? So I was making friends with this woman, and she broke the news to me that she and her family were leaving Fort Collins. They'd only been in town for a few years, but she couldn't take it anymore. That is, the racism. She's African American, and she thought, given the proximity to Denver, Fort Collins, it may be predominantly white, but we'd probably be pretty open and progressive. But she said the cluelessness, the insistence on this being the best place to live, the unwillingness to look at what the realities are like for people of color in this city, and whether or not for them it is in fact the best place to live. She said it was better to go back to the small rural town where she'd moved from than to live in a place so determined to keep up this story, so unwilling, so unable to deal with this, the forces that maintain the status quo. My friend Nathan Ryan, who serves the UU Church in Baton Rouge, he likes to remind me that, in fact, the North is majority white by design. I mean, not too many places were officially whites-only states like Oregon. I'm from the Northwest. I did not grow up knowing that history, but Oregon, if you did not know, it was designated a whites-only state. There is a reason you go to Portland today and you're like, why is this big city so white? By design. Now, as far as I know, there's no other place that was intentionally set aside in exactly that official way, but many places, including Fort Collins, made it very clear that only whites were welcome in shops and in schools. And as landowners or as elected officials, sometimes explicitly, sometimes by way just of networks and norms, and that unwillingness to imagine ourselves as anything other than so white. My friends of color in town like to make a joke that is not funny about there only being limited slots for people of color in Fort Collins, so that if someone new is going to move in, that must mean someone else is about to leave. It is not funny, but also it tells you a little about what the experience is like for someone, a person of color here in Fort Collins. Black people and other people of color have these sorts of conversations every day, their whole lives, about the impact and reality of race. But white folks in Fort Collins, in the church, in general, we lack anything close to that kind of racial stamina. We simply don't have the muscles, the experience, the practice, so we need to work hard to grow those new muscles, the new tools, so that we can have the resilience and the strength to get out of the shame spiral. And instead put ourselves in the middle of what can sometimes be very uncomfortable, embarrassing, hard, and often heartbreaking work. Heartbreaking as in facing the death of a 17-year-old kid armed with a sidewalk, some Skittles, and a hoodie. All of these enough of a threat for his killer to claim self-defense and get away with it. It was this heartbreaking reality in 2013, the reality of George Zimmerman getting away with the murder of Trayvon Martin, that inspired the beginnings of the movement for Black Lives, or what is known today as Black Lives Matter. Three Black women, Alicia Garza, Patrice Cullors, and Opal Tometi, created Black Lives Matter as a way to build Black-centered political will and to grow a new movement that to affirm Black people's humanity, contributions to society, and their resilience in the face of deadly oppression. Now, in my time here at Foothills, I've only known of five people that have left specifically because they disagreed with something that I had said on the Sunday service. People leave for other reasons, okay. But specifically, I know of five. Now, I'll let you guess on the other three what their reasons were, but two of them were because of something that I had said in support of Black Lives Matter. They came to me after that Sunday and said, "They are terrorists, you know. Let me send you an article. They are out to kill the police." I read their article. I was not persuaded. Sitting with my son, watching the footage of white cops beating and shooting, and then the historical footage of white men dragging and pushing and lynching, all with the overlay of Donald Trump's voice during his presidential campaign, where he encouraged the audience towards violence, waxed nostalgic for the good old days when protesters would be taken out on a stretcher. Watching this, I thought once again about Theodore Parker's gun. You know, the gun I told you about last week, Theodore Parker had taken to placing in his desk, given his decision to not cooperate with the 1851 Fugitive Slave Act, I started to think about Theodore Parker's gun. And that question about power. The question of who has it, who needs it, who feels vulnerable, who actually is vulnerable, and then who has the right to defend that power. I don't like thinking about doing to white folks what white folks done to us, Dinez Smith writes. His poem is in many ways still trying to find that line, that question of where violence could be justified. Here, standing in my own body, I say the next time they murder us for the crimes of their imaginations, I don't know what I'll do. George Zimmerman felt afraid for his life, and our courts decided that he had a right to act on that fear. Who feels vulnerable and who actually is vulnerable, who has a right to act on that fear. There was a time in 2008 or so, you might remember it, when people started to say that racism was over. It seems quaint now, but there were headlines. Forbes was one of them. It said, "Racism in America is over." December 30th, 2008. Or actually, really, white folks started to say that racism was over. Still, for all of us, we have to acknowledge there was this moment of hope that we were closer than ever to being able to say to our kids and to ourselves and to our country, yes, that happened a long time ago. It doesn't happen anymore. It is one of the biggest heartbreaks of these past few years in our country and the events of Charlottesville that we have to face the reality that we are not actually there yet, that Black lives do not matter just the same yet. Charlottesville made plain the reality that there remains in our country this great evil. There remains a shadow that haunts us all. It lives in all of us as trauma and shame. And the effects of this evil are played out on Black bodies and in Black lives and in the bodies and lives of people of color every day. Every day, our country and our community keep saying Black lives do not matter the same yet. Which is why our bold Unitarian Universalist proclamation must remain simply, Black lives matter. More than any others in this series, I want to name this one as a statement of faith. Faith as in living as if something is true, as a way of making it so. Because there is no wishing this work away, no pointing to the first principle and thinking, oh, we're all good. There is no automatic progress by way of time just passing. No free pass just because the only people we see most days are white. That should actually motivate us to act all the more. Motivate us to engage in this shame and know it for the trauma that it represents. Motivate us to care for one another in an act of healing. Motivate us to care for people of color who carry this trauma deep in their souls. I'd like to imagine us sometimes as a church of this sort of healing, a people who gather to name the brokenness, the injury, and where we sing and pray and laugh and dance our way to a new wholeness. Thank you. One opportunity for this sort of healing work will launch in October, a program called Beloved Conversation. It is an explicitly Unitarian Universalist small group ministry program based in exploring the role of race in our lives. Still, let's be clear, no program or class is going to close the gap between what is and what is not yet. This work is not like that. It is lifetime work, work of humility and courage. As we say in our opening, it requires undoing systems and norms that were built for a world where Black lives do not matter, and then creating new systems and structures and ways of being, the work of imagining a whole new world into being. A world where you are young and you are Black and your life matters just the same. You stole something and your life matters just the same. I've been taught to fear you and your life matters just the same. A world where we can say, not as a statement of faith, but a statement of fact with honesty and clarity, Black lives matter just the same. May it be so. Amen.